Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Nabil Biagio on this live broadcast from Studio 14 this Monday, June 10th, 2024. A South Sudanese civil society leader participating in peace talks in Nairobi says the Tumaini initiative must address the repeated delays in implementing the 2018 peace agreement.
We think that it is important to investigate why there is this stalemate in the implementation of the agreement, leaving the country wallowing in crisis, economic crisis, as you may know, humanitarian crisis and all of that.
And staff at South Sudan's public universities threaten to go on a strike over unpaid salary arrears.
Not being paid by the government is miserable, so they give the government for 3 days to clear the arrear. And failure to do so, they will go on a strike after 3 days, 72 hours. Our academic staff are dying.
We will have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Civil society delegates participating in peace talks between South Sudan's government and rebel groups in Nairobi say the process, dubbed the Tumaini or Hope Initiative, has facilitated important discussions on crucial governance and peace issues. Rajab Muhandis, a member of the civilian opposition group, the People's Coalition for Civil Action, says while the discussions have been fruitful, the process should address the core problems of South Sudan and investigate the repeated delays in implementing the 2018 peace agreement, which was supposed to lead the nation to its first democratic election by the end of the year.
A lot have been achieved in terms of deliberations and consolidating positions on four subjects or agenda items. And that is governance, economy, security, and justice. The delegates of the respective groups that are participating here deliberated on these four agenda items and presented positions which were then harmonized by the Secretariat of the Mediation. Last week, they presented to the delegations a consolidated report of the four agenda items which were discussed. And so this report was given. It's over seven pages.
If I may, yes, you were presented, because we need some clarification on this. You were presented with a 72-page document just this past weekend, or as you entered the weekend. The document was prepared by the mediation team. What is this document about? Is it an agreement, a memorandum of understanding? What is it?
Well, it is a report of the overall discussions on the four agenda items. It provides harmonized or consolidated positions of all the different delegations. You may recall that the delegations are made up of the representatives of the government in Juba, and then opposition groups and stakeholders, including the civil society and other stakeholders. And so these positions obviously would be different in the way they were presented. And so the mediation had to put them, compile all of them and consolidate them into this report. The last 3 days, we have been reviewing this document to see if what we presented initially were captured in the document and if there are things we wanted to change or add to the document.
Understood. Yes. So it's kind of a summary of what is being discussed, or the notes of your discussions. Rajab, it seems to me, observing this from here, that this process is turning into an attempt to open up the 2018 peace agreement for negotiation in a process that's not really inclusive. I mean, we do have the government, we have the holdout rebel groups, we have civilian opposition like your group, the People's Coalition for Civil Action, we have civil society. And this is not just something I'm observing. The Norwegian Foreign Minister, Espen Barthe, I believe on Friday, and Norway being a key partner of South Sudan and a key sponsor of peace agreements and other important peace and development efforts in the country, he cautioned against that this process should not sideline the 2018 peace agreement that we have in place and trying to implement, because it will throw the country into more chaos. What can you tell our listeners to clarify the agenda of this process that you are part of?
Well, good. Thank you. I think some people still believe the country is not in chaos, even when there are armed opposition groups in conflict with the government. We in the PCCA believe that the country is in crisis, and we also strongly believe that the RRCs has not been fully implemented or not meaningfully implemented. For that reason, I think it is important to consider looking at why the agreement has not been implemented. I am a signatory to the RRCs. I believe in the content of the agreement, but I am frustrated by the way it's being implemented, that it's not delivering peace as initially anticipated. We think that it is important to investigate why there is this stalemate in the implementation of the agreement, leaving the country wallowing in crisis, economic crisis, as you may know, humanitarian crisis and all of that.
The first week you arrived in Nairobi, it was consultations before the actual sessions. I asked you what was going to be achieved by the end of the process. You said it was too early to tell, but I can tell you something. People are expecting two outcomes. One, the December 2024 elections will be delayed again. Two, opposition groups, civilian and rebel groups, including your group, civilian opposition group, will be brought on board and become part of the government. Am I wrong? Are people wrong to think that?
Well, let us put this into perspective, that the delay in conducting the election is not really because there is this Tumaini initiative ongoing in Nairobi. The process for conducting the election has not been funded. All of these activities have not been carried out to prepare the country for election. So that is completely a separate issue. And one of the reasons why there is need for South Sudanese actually to discuss why we can't conduct elections since we became independent. And the second thing is that it is not about shortage of political parties and politicians and civil society and civil rights movements like the PCCA in Juba. We have politicians in excess, and still the agreement is not being implemented. So it is not just that we need to add more, get more people who are outside into the country, but we need to, in our view, understand why, even with all the agreements signed and those who signed the agreement in Juba, not much is happening. That, to us, is what matters about this process. And so this process must provide answers to those things, as opposed to trying to relate it to the elections, when we very well know that the elections will not be conducted because there is no adequate preparation.
That was Rajab Muhandis, civil society leader and member of the opposition group, the People's Coalition for Civil Action. He spoke with me from Nairobi, where he's been participating in the talks. Patience is running out among the academic staff at South Sudan's public universities, who say the transitional government has not paid them in more than 8 months. The head of a high-level university panel says academic staffers have issued a 3-day ultimatum for the government to pay their overdue salaries or they will walk off the job. Manyang David Mayar has more from Juba.
Teaching staff at the University of Barre-Ghazal say the government has until Wednesday to pay 8 months of overdue salaries or they will not show up for work. Hakim Bidong, a lecturer and secretary general of the Academic Association at the University of Barre-Ghazal, says teachers are living a miserable life and cannot wait any longer.
We had a meeting on Friday. All the academic staff of the University of Barre-Ghazal, they came with a resolution in that meeting that the situation that they have for 8 months not being paid by the government is miserable. So they give the government for 3 days to clear the arrears. And failure to do so, they will go on a strike after 3 days, 72 hours. Our academic staff are dying in their houses.
The University of Barre-Ghazal is not alone. Staff members at Rumbek University of Science and Technology issued a similar ultimatum. Adam Thambo is chairperson of the High-Level Committee of Academic Staff Associations at the five public universities tasked with following up on the unpaid salaries with the government. He says efforts to meet with the relevant government institutions, including the office of Hossein Abdelbaghi Akol, Vice President for Service Cluster, did not succeed.
We wrote a letter to the Minister of Higher Education, we want to sit down and talk about the solution of all these things. Fortunately, the Honorable is actually in peace talk in Nairobi, and he used to be busy. We went also to meet His Excellency Chair of the office. We used to meet just only the secretaries and the office manager in the office that used to tell us the vice president is busy.
Reached by phone from the Kenyan capital Nairobi, Gabriel Changson Chang, South Sudan's higher education minister, says his office does not pay the university academic staff.
Talk to them. Don't talk to me. I don't pay money. To bring money from where? Please, I'm not in Juba. I don't want to comment.
Simon Ngor, Director General of Information and Communications at South Sudan's Finance Ministry, says he's gathering information on the whereabouts of the teaching staff salaries.
I'm telling you that I'm still filing the information because I asked in the office of the minister and office of the undersecretary, I did not find them. So let me get the information and then I can inform you.
While it is unclear whether the government will pay teaching staff their overdue salaries, students at the South Sudan's public universities are worried about their studies. Jok Majuk, a fourth-year student at the College of Economics at the University of Bahr El Ghazal, urges teachers and professors to continue with their duties while demanding their right to get paid.
Let them be doing their voice to be heard by the authority, the government. To pay them the salary, because if they lay down the truth now, it is too much to us to be staying in this crisis. It is better for us to be sitting with our academically so that we can go. It's not a time for us to be staying long time in the school. Meanwhile, we didn't do anything. The government should intervene to see what to pay them the salary.
The University of Bahr El Ghazal expects to administer its examination in July. Majok worries exams will be interrupted if the government fails to pay academic staff salaries. Last month, Finance Minister Wo Daniel Chuang told lawmakers the government is unable to pay civil servant salaries due to a lack of financial resources because oil exports were disrupted by the Sudan conflict, which began a year ago. For VOA News, Amanyang David Mayor in Juba.
Residents of a Juba neighborhood are threatening to forcibly close an ice factory in the area. The residents say it has caused environmental damage, but the owner says it is because he refused to give them free electricity. Dennis Logonyi reports for VOA from Juba.
Residents of the Juba Naba residential area have locked horns with an IC company, alleging salty chemicals the company uses are affecting their environment. Lona Peter blames the chemicals for damaging her plants and says she fears for her health.
We didn't know that this company had an effect and it started working as time passed by. We realized our things are dying. Trees, oranges, mangoes, guava, all are dying. And our houses are falling. The cement is wearing off. You renew in 2 months, it will wear off. If the ice company owner was doing a different business which has no effect with us, as his neighbors, we would have no issue with him.
The city council had closed the factory in April because of complaints from the area residents. Osam Abdul Khalid, the owner of the AK Ice Factory, says his factory followed the legal procedures to get the factory reopened. With the approval of the city council, he says the complaints come from residents angry over electricity supplies.
There are some 4 or 5 families that I didn't give power because my generator cannot provide for all the people. I gave to my neighbors electricity for free who are close to me, like 8 families, but I could not manage to provide for everyone because my generator is for business and its power could not manage to provide 20 or 30 families. That's the genesis of the problem.
Some residents say it appears rain washes salty chemicals from the plant down to their properties. Lawanila Durombe says after realizing what the factory was doing to the local neighborhood, he demanded it be shut down.
I've lived in this area since 2005. Till now, this company came in 2015 after 10 years when I've lived in this area. And if you see my trees I planted in 2005, all have died. Who will pay for my trees? We want the company to relocate. relocate without compensation so that we can plant other trees. Let him go and look for places suitable for factories.
Resident Tongun Emmanuel says the city council should not have allowed the factory to reopen without an assessment from experts at the Ministry of Environment.
We need environmental auditors to come and audit this company, whether the company is causing damage or not. And the very person who knows this is the mayor of Juba City Council, because he's unable to solve our problem.
Nyarso Patrick, a youth leader in the area, says they want higher government authorities to get involved.
We are raising our voice very strong that with immediate effect, we want AK Ice Factory to be closed within our residential area. Failure to do so, the people of Jubanabari Northern Zone will take law into their hand, because we have taken all the legal steps. And we are calling upon the Ministry of Environment and the Bureau of Standard and even the Governor of Central Equatoria to interfere, because the mayor have failed to resolve the issue.
Flora Gabriel, the mayor of Juba City Council, is calling on the residents of the area to remain calm. She says she is willing to solve the issue and asked the Jubanabari Zone leaders to deliver a report in 3 days.
Let them just wait, and we are working on this issue, and I've given it to the zone director to give me the details so that we take it officially, that we close it up with evidence from them. And we are not going to target this company alone. There's another company ahead near the cemetery. Let them not also say things which are not right. It has to go systematically, you know. I know they are affected and we have to close it down, but in right procedure.
The city council allowed the ice factory to reopen last month after studying the legal implications of closing it down. For VOA News, I'm Dennis Logonyi reporting from Juba.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, aid agencies say hospitals in Darfur are being destroyed by violence. Stay tuned.
Hello, listener of South Sudan in Focus. We have an exciting new segment dubbed Words of Wisdom. We want to hear your thoughtful proverbs that echo through your community. This is another chance for you to share wisdom from your roots. All you need to do is record a proverb in a language of your choice, tell us its English translation and what it means. Keep it brief, authentic, and represent your community. Your recorded proverb shall be sampled on South Sudan in Focus every Wednesday. Send your recording via our WhatsApp number, +1 202 630 8011. That is +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. In Sudan's North Darfur state, displaced people and doctors say the paramilitary rapid support forces are attacking hospitals and camps in the state capital of Al-Fashir. Meanwhile, nonprofits say the world is paying little attention as a city that was supposed to be a haven for those forced out of their homes by Sudan's war is being torn apart. Henry Wilkins has the details.
Al-Fashir, the capital city of North Darfur state, was supposed to be safe. About 800,000 people displaced by fighting and alleged ethnic cleansing in the surrounding Darfur countryside have fled here hoping to find refuge. But since mid-April, Al-Fashir too has become a war zone. Refugee camps have been caught in the crossfire and even shelled as the Sudanese military battles the paramilitary rapid support forces for control of the city. More than 1,200 have been killed, says Doctors Without Borders. From inside Al-Fashir, Adam Rojal, a spokesperson for a local non-profit helping Darfur's displaced, told VOA that people here don't care about the warring sides. They just want the fighting to stop. He says the military and the RSF are not patriots and are fighting only in their own interests, adding that the only loser is Sudanese society, especially people in Darfur. He says people have lost everything, even basic needs to live, like food, water, shelter, and medicine. He says words can't describe how serious the situation is. Claire Nicolette works with the non-profit Doctors Without Borders, which operates medical facilities in Al-Fashir. She said one of its maternity wards was shelled, as well as the main surgical hospital.
The roof fall down on babies that were inside the hospital, and we had to close down after the death of these two children. Surgical hospital, I can say, which is receiving all the wounded at the moment, has been touched four times now in 10 days.
Nicolette said calls from the UN, US Secretary of State Antony Blinken, and other members of the international community to end the fighting in Al-Fasha have gone unheeded. She says the situation is only getting worse and that the violence is indiscriminate.
We hear about drones now, we hear about snipers, so we just see that the situation is just deteriorating over and over. It's kind of full war inside the city, so unfortunately there is no protection of civilians, no protection of health structures whatsoever. That's the reality.
Rojal says the fighting has prevented people from leaving the city and aid groups from delivering food to the starving within its borders. He says families are living in dire conditions, himself included, because they're not getting aid from the UN's World Food Programme because of the poor security and conditions of the blockade. Every day, he has been desperately sending pictures of malnourished children in Al-Fasha to the international press to try to get the world's attention. Non-profits have complained about the unusually low donations for the Sudan crisis, in part because of the Ukraine and Gaza wars, while human rights groups have criticised the UN and African Union for not doing enough. Meanwhile, Al-Fasha continues to be ripped apart. Henry Wilkins, VOA News.
East African Community Heads of State appointed and is swearing the organization's first female Secretary General during a virtual summit held on Friday. The appointment of Veronica Mweni Nduva from Kenya comes as the East Africa region is experiencing a financial crisis and insecurity in eastern DRC. Moses Javier Rimana reports.
For the first time since the East African Community was founded in 1967, the East African Community will now have a female Secretary General, Veronica Mweni Nduva from Kenya. She will serve a period of less than 2 years, succeeding Dr. Peter Mathuki, who was recalled in March by Kenyan President William Ruto amid financial mismanagement allegations. Nduva said that her tenure will focus on promoting deeper integration of the community.
In this regard, my priorities will be strengthen economic integration that encourages innovation, entrepreneurship, and job creation. In promoting peace and security, a secure East Africa is the foundation upon which we can build lasting prosperity.
Peace and security is still one of the major challenges the East African Community is facing. During the summit, Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni hailed President Salva Kiir of South Sudan, who is the current chair of the Heads of State Summit.
I want to thank His Excellency President Salva Kiir Mayardit for the trips he made to Rwanda, to Burundi, to Congo, DRC, to Angola on the issue of the peace in Eastern Congo. We need peace in Congo.
DRC joined the East African Community in 2022, but saw its relations with the neighboring Rwanda deteriorate as the latter is accused of supporting the M23 rebels that have caused insecurity in the eastern DRC. Despite joining the community 2 years ago, DRC is yet to meet its annual contributions, making it the biggest defaulter, owing the community $14.7 million of the $39.8 million the member states owe the community. Currently, activities of the East African Court of Justice and the Legislative Assembly have been suspended due to lack of funds. Fred Mukasambide is an East African Community Integration expert and vice president of the Democratic Party of Uganda.
Finances of the East African Community are completely muddled. That definitely owes to the higgledy-piggledy nature within which, of course, partner states find themselves sending subventions to the East African Community coffers. The goodwill is what is lacking, and what is more material right now is an establishment of a process and a policy that requires GDP contributions per annum from all partner states.
An alternative financing mechanism was drafted by the East African Community more than a decade ago, which requires member states to contribute a percentage based on their GDP. The new Secretary General is taking the helm of the community that is under a financial and political crisis. Moses Aviarimana, for Voice of America.
And that's all we have for you this Monday. Don't forget to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you missed this broadcast, go to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. We leave you with Ras Corby and the song Jamila. I am your host, Nabil Biagio in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer Chang, thanks for taking the time to be with us. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
At last count, the number of people displaced by war, violence, and persecution reached 114 million, according to UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi. That number is expected to rise in this month's tally. One of the major causes of the growing disaster is the fact that nearly all parties to conflicts have stopped respecting the basic rules of war. Increasingly, civilians are targeted, while rape and sexual violence are used as weapons of war. And since the brutal conduct is meant to terrify, civilians have no choice but to flee, he said. But even as more people need help, less is available, and humanitarians are near their breaking point. The United States continues to take significant action worldwide to support refugees in the countries who host them, said Robert Wood, United States Alternative Representative for Special Political Affairs.
The United States is the largest single humanitarian donor in the world. In our fiscal year 2023 alone, we provided nearly $15 billion in global humanitarian assistance on behalf of the American people.
In 2023, we welcomed 60,014 resettled refugees to the United States, and we are on track to reach or surpass 100,000 arrivals this year. We are doing our part, and we call on other member states to do more, said Ambassador Wood.
We are proud that our refugee admissions program brings refugees from every continent and corner of the world, 79 nationalities from 95 host countries this fiscal year. We believe all refugees from all backgrounds and with all skill sets are deserving of durable solutions, including third country resettlement. This administration is especially proud of its work to help resettle LGBTQI plus refugees fleeing persecution from around the world.
Protection of refugees is crucial. However, more than ever before, we need humanitarian financing, development efforts, and private sector investments to work in concert to effectively address today's complex forced displacement crises, said Ambassador Wood.
We need greater emphasis on local and regional solutions, including lawful pathways for refugees and migrants to move safely and in dignity. The safe mobility offices in Central and South America highlight our efforts in this area.
We remain steadfast in our commitment to protection as the bedrock of humanitarian response, self-reliance, and durable solutions, rooted in the self-identified needs of affected persons, said Ambassador Wood. Today, refugees, asylum seekers, and stateless persons around the world need our commitment to protect them.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.